or I'd have wound up in a ditch. Obviously, Charlotte had no choice but to try and push the baby out in her bedroom. And so Charlotte tried. At 6:10, in the early minutes of her fourth hour of pushing, Charlotte Fugit Bedford suffered what my mother was convinced was a ruptured cerebral aneurysm, or what she would refer to in her own mind as a stroke. She imagined that the intracranial pressure of Charlotte's exertions had caused a small vessel inside the poor woman's brain to burst. Asa and my mother, right up until that moment, were still telling Charlotte she could do it. She could get that little baby through her and into the bedroom with them. "My, oh my, you're great, Charlotte. The best, the best. Another second, another second, another second." Asa had moved between his wife's legs to catch the child, while Anne and my mother were at her sides, holding her. Abruptly, while struggling in the midst of a contraction, Charlotte's chin shot up from her chest as she pushed with whatever energy she had left. She opened her eyes and then exhaled with a small squeal. Her husband saw her eyes roll up, then close. My mother and Anne felt the body grow limp in their arms as Charlotte lost consciousness. She seemed to go fast. Respiratory distress began almost immediately. My mother was about as well trained as the volunteers on the town rescue squad, and she tried to revive Charlotte. She knelt beside her and blew deep into the woman's lungs through her mouth, attempting to restart her breathing. She pushed down hard upon Charlotte's chest with the heels of her hands. 15 compressions and 2 breaths. 15 compressions followed by 2 breaths. There didn't seem to be a pulse, and my mother pleaded with Charlotte to breathe as she worked. She was crying as she counted aloud, and she begged the woman to fight for her life. "You can do it, damn it. I know you can. You can. You can. You can. Please," Anne said, my mother demanded, of the apparently dead woman. But at some point, within minutes of what my mother believed had been a stroke, after my mother concluded her cardiopulmonary resuscitation had failed to generate a pulse or a breath, she screamed for Asa and Anne to find her the sharpest knife in the house. Asa would say in court that he did as she asked without thinking. He would say he had no idea what my mother intended to do with the knife. He would say he believed at the time that my mother was going to use the knife to somehow try and save his wife's life. My mother was a midwife, and he was not. My mother knew CPR, and he did not. My mother was in charge, and he was not. Perhaps he was anticipating a tracheotomy. Perhaps not. Perhaps in reality he knew. Perhaps not. Anne would insist she went with Asa for different reasons at different times. Once it was because she couldn't bear to stay in the room with the dead woman. Once it was because she was afraid to stay in the room with my mother. My mother suddenly seemed insane to her. For whatever the reason, Asa and Anne ran downstairs to the kitchen together, and Asa pulled from the wooden block back on the counter beyond Fugie's reach a knife that was 10 inches long. When they returned, my mother said through her tears,
"I can't get a pulse, Asa. I can't bring her back."
"Can't you do more CPR?"
Asa asked, dropping the knife on the foot of the bed.
"Oh God, Asa, I could do it for days, but she'd still be gone. She's not coming back."
As Asa had much earlier that evening, the night before now really, he knelt by the side of that bed. He rested his head on his wife's chest and murmured her name, and my mother squeezed his shoulder once. And then my mother moved with a suddenness that frightened both Asa and Anne.
"Let's go," she said, still sniffling. "We've got no time."
With the same hand that had squeezed his shoulder only seconds before, she picked the knife up off the sheets. What she did not do, and when the state's attorney went over this in the courtroom with Anne, her testimony made even me doubt my mother for a brief moment, was ask Asa what he wanted to do. She never asked the father if he wanted her to try and save the baby. If he had said no, she could have done it anyway if that's what she wanted. But if he had said yes, she at least would have had complicity. And she never placed the fetal scope back upon Charlotte's stomach to see if there was still a fetal heartbeat. Of course, the baby would prove to be alive, but not checking one last time before she did what she did, it surprised and shocked even the novice midwife. And from the moment Asa and Anne returned to the bedroom until the moment my mother began to cut, she never checked one last time to see if Charlotte had a pulse or a heartbeat. Maybe she had, as she said under oath, checked just before they returned with the knife. But neither the father nor the apprentice witnessed my mother make sure Charlotte was dead before she plunged a kitchen knife into the woman.
What do you mean?
Asa asked my mother after she said to him that they had no time.
The baby's only got a few minutes, and we used most of them on Charlotte.
What are you going to do?
Save your baby!
My mother's voice was shrill, both Asa and Anne thought, and Asa said in court he wondered if she was hysterical. My mother insisted that if her voice was shrill, it was because she wanted to snap Asa to attention.
Save the baby.
Save your baby!
Asa stood up and walked behind my mother as she turned on the reading lamp by the bed for the first time that night.
Is she dead?
God, Asa, yes, of course.
Was she?
We'll never know for sure. The medical examiner would be one of many state witnesses who would say it was medically possible that Charlotte Fugit Bedford's heart may have stopped for a moment, but my mother's diligent CPR had revived it, and for a time, revived the woman. But there was no doubt in Asa's or Anne's minds that my mother believed Charlotte was dead. When my mother said to Asa that,
"Yes, of course,"
his wife was dead, he nodded, and my mother took that motion as an assent. Certainly, Asa made no effort to stop her. He lumbered slowly to the window without saying a word and looked into the sky, which seemed destined to remain dark forever. My mother would say later that in the early morning hours of March 14th, she performed the emergency cesarean because she couldn't bear to see two people die. She just couldn't bear it. And Charlotte was dead without question. Was my mother wrong? Anne thought so, just as the medical examiner certainly believed there was room for doubt. Asa was standing by the window when my mother made the first cut, but he said later that, like Anne, he saw blood spurt. Blood powered, the state's attorney would insist, by a pumping heart. But Anne said nothing at the time, too young to be sure of what she had seen. It would be hours before she would pick up the phone, confused, unable to sleep, and call my mother's backup physician. She would later say that she could not believe blood would have spurted like that from a dead woman, but my mother's attorney said there was probably another reason she called Dr. Hewitt. Stephen Hastings always viewed Anne as a nervous rat jumping from the Titanic. She made that critical phone call late in the morning, while miles away in Burlington, the medical examiner was in the midst of his autopsy, trying, and failing, to find a sign of the cerebral aneurysm. My mother ran a fingernail in an imaginary line from Charlotte's navel to her pubic bone. Her hands were shaking. She remembered reading somewhere that a surgeon could pull a baby from its mother in a crisis in 20 or 30 seconds, but that didn't seem possible to her. All those layers, cutting into a human, not wanting to cut the fetus, it just didn't seem possible. She pretended the line she had sketched below Charlotte's navel was real, and then pressed the tip of the carving knife hard into the dead woman's skin. Blood burst from Charlotte at the point of incision in rhythmic spurts. These were not, Anne said, the powerful geysers one would expect from a healthy beating heart, but the little spasms one might get from a weak one. Nevertheless, the blood seemed to Anne to be pulsing through Charlotte and pumping from her where my mother had made the cut. When she saw the blood spurt momentarily into the air, splattering my mother's fingers, the idea first began to form in Anne Austen's mind that my mother was performing a cesarean on a living woman. But Anne hadn't noticed Charlotte's body move. She hadn't seen a reflexive spasm or twitch. And quickly, the pulsation stopped, and the blood merely flowed. My mother pressed the blade further into the woman. The blood rolled down the woman's belly and spilled onto the sheets on the bed to create fresh stains. My mother pressed a pillow onto the wound for a brief moment to soak up some of the blood so she could see inside the incision. As she held the pillow there, she said later, she heard her teeth begin chattering inside her head before she actually felt and understood what the noise was. Somehow, she was sweating. When she pulled the pillow away, she saw the smooth, shining half-shell of the uterus. Globular, clean, almost fruity. My mother wasn't squeamish, but she said the sight made her dizzy, because here was life at its most visceral, most primal. Here was life in the womb. She ran her fingertips over the fundus until she understood where the baby was, and then grabbed the knife off the mattress. Using its tip like a pin, she pricked the uterus like a balloon in a spot far from the fetus. She then placed a finger into the uterus and tore it open gently with both hands, afraid to sever it with a knife. The baby was too near. She would recall in the courtroom that tearing the uterus was as easy as tearing damp pastry dough, but she was nevertheless finding it hard to breathe as she worked. When the opening was large enough for her hand, she reached deep inside and felt the baby's face. Her palm grazed its nose, and she ran her hand across its skull, its neck, its spine, until she had discovered one of its fat, pudgy thighs. She slid her hand up its leg until she had one foot, and then reached in her other hand for the child's other foot. She then ripped the body from its mother, and in the air of the bedroom, the fetus instantly became, in my mother's eyes, an infant. A boy. And when she had sucked the mucus from his throat with an ear syringe, and he slowly came around, gasping, then breathing, then finally howling, he became for his father a living reminder of Charlotte Fugit Bedford's life and death, and unspeakable ordeal. Eleanor Snow arrived this morning, and she is the most amazingly lovely little thing. Dottie Snow's labor was quick. She had her two sisters with her, her mom, and of course Chuck was there. He and Dottie were smooching and hugging between each surge. But what made the aura in that room so powerful was the combination of husband-wife love, sister love, and mother-daughter love. I wish I could have bottled the vibes in that room and saved a little for some of the lonelier births. Lonely births are the saddest thing in the world. They can bring me down for days. Charlotte Bedford's birth might be a lonely birth. Charlotte has no family anywhere near her. And I don't think I've met a single female friend of hers. Female or male. No doubt about it. Hers could be a lonely birth.
From the notebooks of Sybil Danforth. Midwife. My mother wasn't home from the Bedford birth by breakfast. School had not been canceled that day, but the first classes had been pushed back 2 hours to allow the road crews time to turn the winding ice rinks back into roads, and so my father left for work before I left for school. Charlotte Fugit Bedford and her son Vale went their separate ways soon after Vale was born. Charlotte's body was rushed in the funeral director's van to Burlington after the state's attorney and the medical examiner had surveyed the bedroom. The medical examiner informed my mother that he would be performing an autopsy, but he said it was a standard practice and nothing that should alarm her. My mother, Asa, and Anne actually left the Bedfords before the men in suits and uniforms. They went with Vale to North Country Hospital in Newport, where pediatricians would examine him carefully. It was from the hospital that my mother phoned my father at his office and told him what had occurred. Her plan was to tell me in person when I returned home from school. Like everything else surrounding the birth of Vale Bedford, it didn't work out as my mother expected. News of accidental death, especially when it is grisly, travels fast in our corner of Vermont. Consequently, I learned of Charlotte Bedford's death during gym class just before lunch. I was changing from my gym shorts to blue jeans when Sadie Demarest told me, "That weird preacher up in Lawson lost his wife."
"She died?" I asked.
"Yep, in childbirth."
And I murmured aloud a thought that I do not believe had yet passed through Sadie's mind. "I wonder if my mother was there."
Sadie paused on the bench before her locker.
"Your mom was her midwife?" she asked, and I nodded.
I could see that the idea that my mother might have been present frightened Sadie and changed her perception of the story dramatically. Suddenly, this little nightmare involved Connie Danforth's mother. Connie Danforth's mother had not only been with the dead woman, she had been helping her have her baby. And people weren't supposed to die having babies, not even in our rural corner of the kingdom. When I got home from school, my father was in the kitchen, my mother was sleeping. "How is school?" he asked.
"Fine."
"Good. Good. You'll need to be gentle with Mom for a while," he added.
"Because of what happened?"
"What have you heard?"
"I heard Mrs. Bedford died."
He shook his head sadly. "Why don't you tell me what you know, then I'll tell you what I know," The details? If you don't already know them. At 13, I did not understand the details of how malpractice insurance worked, but I knew that Vermont midwives didn't carry any. There were no companies that offered it to them in the state, and I knew this was an issue on occasion between my parents, usually after my mother would return home from what she would describe as a complicated birth. I think the afternoon after Charlotte Bedford died, this was my father's chief concern as well, a civil suit. I don't believe the idea that state troopers would be arriving at our home within hours had crossed his mind. No one knew if the baby died, too. Did it? No, the baby's alive and doing fine. They had a little boy. That's good, at least. It is, yes. What are people saying? All I heard was that Mrs. Bedford had died in childbirth, and it was incredibly bloody. But I know childbirth is always bloody, and no one seemed to be able to tell me why.
Why?
Why it was so bloody. He toyed with one of his sideburns.
Were the kids asking you a lot of questions?
No, just one. They kept asking me if Mom was there.
And you told them she was? I nodded.
Was that okay?
God, Connie, of course it was. Your mom did absolutely nothing wrong, nothing. Sometimes women die in childbirth, just like sometimes people get sick and die. It's sad, very sad. But these things happen.
Was it bloody?
Yes, it was very bloody.
He might have told me then that my mother had performed a cesarean section, but in the hallway above us, we heard footsteps. We both realized Sybil was awake, and she was on her way downstairs. My father would leave it to her to tell me a few sketchy details of what had occurred in the Bedfords' bedroom early that morning. When my mother entered the kitchen, her eyes were so red they looked painful. She looked old to me, and it was not simply because she was limping or because there were dark bags under her eyes. That aura, to use one of my mother's favorite words, of limitless enthusiasm that seemed to surround her, had dissipated. The energy, part optimism, part patience, part joy, that sometimes seemed to fill whole rooms when she entered, had vanished. My mother said very little in the hours between when I returned home from school and when the state troopers arrived. She sat on the couch in the den in her nightgown, with a quilt draped over her shoulders. The little room smelled like cinnamon from the herbal tea she was sipping. Whenever the phone rang, my father answered it and dealt with the caller. About 5:30, the sun broke through once and for all, not long before it would disappear for the night into the western horizon. But for a few minutes, sunlight filled the den, and the fire my father had started in the wood stove earlier in the day seemed unnecessary. Twice my mother asked me how school had been that day, but I knew neither time she heard my response. Once she asked my father for more aspirin for the pain in her ankle, and when he brought her the pills and a glass of cold water, he had to remind her that she herself had requested them.
"Let's have that ankle x-rayed tomorrow," my father suggested.
"Yes, let's," my mother said. But most of the time the three of us sat in silence. For some reason I was afraid to leave the house, and I was afraid to be upstairs alone in my room, and so I sat with my parents in the den. I believe we all understood on some level that something well beyond our control was about to occur. My father and I saw the state police cruiser rolling slowly up our driveway Friday night, around dusk. I was flattening ground meat into hamburgers, and my father was beside me, reaching into the cabinet for a skillet. My mother was still in the den, unmoving and silent, but awake.
"I'll see to that," my father said, perhaps hoping he could shoo the police away as if they were a pair of vacuum cleaner salesmen.
My mother heard the knock on the door and grew more alert. When she realized who had come to our house, she rose from the cushions and pillows and somehow found the strength to amble into the front hall. And so I ventured there too.
"I really believe this can wait until tomorrow," my father was saying.
"I'm sorry, I can't," one of the officers said, although his voice suggested that he certainly understood my father's desire to give my mother a night of peace. "But I promise this won't take too long."
The officers were tall and both well into middle age. One had a white mustache trimmed so severely it looked a bit menacing. The other had the sort of sharp, deep creases across his face that I always associated with farmers. The sort of wrinkles that come from driving a tractor into autumn winds for days and days at a time. They nodded at my mother as if they knew her, and I got the impression they'd probably met her at the Bedfords that morning. My father motioned them inside. I tried to remind myself that these two powerful-looking men were not evil,
They both wore wedding bands. They probably had children. They were just regular old guys. There was no reason I should be frightened of them. But of course, I was.
"I'm Sergeant Leland Rhodes," the one with the mustache began, "and this is Corporal Richard Tilly."
"Rand Danforth," my father said, extending his hand. When he turned, he saw my mother and me standing in the hallway behind him.
"Connie, why don't you go upstairs? This shouldn't take long."
My mother made them coffee. That was the first thing that surprised me. The next day, I gather, Stephen Hastings would think that this was one of the strangest things he had ever heard.
"Coffee," my father said, the lawyer repeated over and over. "You made them coffee."
The officers were courteous.
"We just want to know what you saw," Sergeant Rhodes said, as if my mother were a mere spectator. "We want you to tell us what happened, while the memories are still fresh."
"I don't think my memories of last night will ever go away," my mother responded. And years later, my father would tell me that one sentence made a huge difference in what happened next. Apparently, my mother's eyes grew watery as she spoke, and my father feared she might finally, and suddenly, break down. He became so worried about her emotional well-being that he failed to cut short the interview or inform both the troopers that there would be no further conversation until they had an attorney present. He told me the idea had already begun to form that they would need a lawyer, but in his mind it would be to defend against a civil suit, not a criminal charge.
"That's probably true, Mrs. Danforth, but Bill Tanner and I have both found over the years that some details are more crisp when you talk about them right away," Rhodes said.
"Bill Tanner?" my mother asked. "Why do I know that name?"
"He's the state's attorney for Orleans County. You met him this morning."
Once the troopers had left, my father told my mother he hadn't realized the state's attorney had been at the Bedfords that morning. Either my mother had forgotten to tell him, or she hadn't realized who William Tanner was, or why the fellow had joined the medical examiner at the Bedfords' house. And so when Rand Danforth interrupted with the question any husband protector might ask in that situation, he asked it timidly, without conviction.
"Should we have our attorney present?"
he wondered aloud.
"Sure, if you'd like. But all we're doing right now is filling in the blanks in the story," Rhodes said, his voice casual and unconcerned.
Would things have ended differently if my mother had remained silent at that moment, or if my father had insisted that they postpone any discussions until they had an attorney present? It's possible, but it isn't likely. Even Stephen Hastings decided there was little that was particularly incriminating in the portion of the affidavit gathered that first evening. Mostly the troopers had simply allowed my mother to tell her side of the story, to present what she believed had occurred. Stephen did make a pretrial issue of what he called the interrogation, quote-unquote, but he also told us before the suppression hearing that the state would probably prevail, which it did. Besides, my parents didn't even have an attorney that night. They had used lawyers just twice before in their lives, once to write their wills in the days immediately before I was born, and then a second time when my father started his own architectural firm. And the fact that the two troopers did not actively encourage my parents to have a lawyer present would actually prove helpful to Stephen in one small way when the case finally came to trial. He used that fact to help bolster his contention that the state had a vendetta against home birth and was more interested in putting midwives out of business than protecting my mother's civil liberties. In any event, my mother said both to the two police officers and to my father after he broached the idea of a lawyer, "I haven't done anything wrong." Her voice was incredulous, not defensive, as if she couldn't believe an attorney would ever be necessary. "I'll tell you exactly what happened. What do you need to know?" Corporal Richard Tilly began taking notes. The state trooper stayed in our den for over an hour, nodding and scribbling. Finally, Rhodes took the pad from the corporal and passed it across the coffee table to my mother.
"Why don't you read this, Mrs. Danforth, and make sure we have everything right," he said, as Tilly handed my mother his pen.
My mother read through the pages.
Tilly had usually captured the gist of what she had said, and it seemed to her that was all that should matter at that point.
"Is the story accurate?" Rhodes asked her. "Did Richard here even come close?"
He continued smiling.
"It's more or less what happened," my mother said.
"Good, good," Rhodes murmured.
He then made the request of my mother that would finally lead both of my parents to realize they needed a lawyer. A criminal attorney. And they needed one, immediately. Nodding as if his request were small, a bit of minor and inconsequential protocol, Rhodes asked,
Would you swear to the truth of it for us, please? And then sign it?
Charlotte spent a half hour today looking at all of the pictures of babies and moms on my wall. Charlotte says she wants a girl. Fugi says he wants a boy. And Asa just wants a healthy baby. Charlotte tells me that's all Asa prays for from the birth. Another healthy child. That's all he says that matters. A healthy baby. Charlotte's taking good care of herself. I'm sure he'll get his wish. From the notebooks of Sybil Danforth, midwife. My mother did sign the affidavit. My father tried to stop her, but my mother believed that she had done absolutely nothing wrong. I'll sign it, she said to my father, and she did, scrawling her name in large, proud letters. Saturday morning, my parents were up and around well before me. I knew they were seeing lawyers. Friday night, my father had spoken by phone to attorneys at three firms, two in Montpelier and one in Burlington. The Burlington attorney was Stephen Hastings. They left soon after I'd finished my breakfast, and I spent most of that day in a daze. Tom Quartz and I had been going steady by then for close to 4 months. Tom and I were supposed to have gone to a dance together Friday night, a shindig at the American Legion post in Montpelier, of all things. I had not gone with Tom to the dance that Friday night, however. By the time most of us started piling into school buses to go home at 3, Tom had heard that one of Sybil Danforth's mothers had died. We discussed it briefly before each of our last classes began, and his take was at once characteristically prescient and prickly. That preacher's probably upset, but it's the doctors who'll come after her. Doctors think they know everything. And then after a long pause, he added, they scare me, doctors do. They're like pack animals, wolves. They surround their prey and go right for the throat. Tom had called me late Friday night, close to 11. He said he couldn't come by my house Saturday morning because he'd agreed to help an older cousin move into a new apartment in St. Johnsbury, but he said he'd be by in the afternoon. I told him that would be fine. When my mother and father left, they told me they wouldn't be back until late in the day and that I should screen incoming calls. They were concerned that newspaper reporters would phone us, and their fears were well-founded. I spent much of the day listening to the messages reporters and family friends and other midwives would leave on the answering machine and waiting for Tom to come by. Usually, if I was expecting Tom when my parents weren't home, I'd anticipate that we would wind up quickly on the couch in the den. The Saturday that my parents went searching for a lawyer, however, the idea that Tom and I might make a beeline toward the couch never even crossed my mind. Just before lunch, Raleigh came over, and for about an hour the two of us listened to the calls coming in to the answering machine. By the time Raleigh arrived, I'd had to put in a second cassette tape to preserve the messages, and still people called. It was endless. Eventually, even Raleigh grew tired of listening to the calls and went home about 1:30. Tom didn't get to our house until close to 3, and in the hour and a half in between, I continued to stare at the answering machine and watch its red eye blink. Only once did I pick up the receiver and talk to someone, and that was when I heard my father's voice speaking from a phone in the attorney's office in Burlington.
How are you doing? He asked me.
Oh, fine.
What have you been up to?
Reading.
I lied. I was afraid he and my mother would worry if they knew the truth, and envisioned me sitting with my arms wrapped around my knees, transfixed by the telephone answering machine. Have you been on the phone?
Little, I guess.
Any calls for your mom?
A few.
Friends or reporters?
Both.
Okay. When your mom and I are done with Mr. Hastings, we're going to go by the hospital to get your mom's ankle x-rayed.
I probably looked like eighth grade hell to Tom when I opened the door for him. I was as vain as any girl just shy of 14, but I hadn't combed my hair once that Saturday, and I don't believe I had remembered to brush my teeth. But if Tom was appalled by what he saw when I opened the door, he kept his disappointment to himself. He wrapped his arms around the small of my back and pulled me to him and gave me a kiss on the lips as gentle and chaste as the first one we'd shared a year earlier in the mud of the McKenna family's small paddock. And then he just rocked me for a long moment, an awkward sway that felt just right for that time. I pressed my forehead against the cotton from his shirt that peeked through his partly zipped parka, lulled, if not wholly reassured. I don't recall how he finally separated our two bodies and moved us inside. It was quickly apparent that Tom, like me, had absolutely no idea of how much or how little he should speak of Mrs. Bedford's death
or my mother's involvement. My cousin lives in a pit, were his first words to me. It's dark and old and in need of either a good carpenter or a well-placed bolt of lightning. He sat down on a corner of the floor by the stereo and began thumbing through the record albums and tapes lined up to one side.
"How's your mom today?" he asked, careful to look intently at an album cover instead of at me.
"I think her ankle hurts more than she'll admit."
"She picked out a lawyer?"
"I don't know." In the kitchen, the phone rang, and when I didn't move to answer it, Tom looked up at me and offered to get it.
"Let the answering machine deal with it," I told him, and explained how up until perhaps an hour earlier, the phone had been ringing nonstop.
Not surprisingly, it was merely a reporter calling yet again.
"Has your mom spoken to any newspapers yet?"
"I don't think so."
"Do you think she should?"
"I don't know. Maybe."
"Get her side out there."
"Her side? What do you mean, her side?"
"Look, honey, I don't know much about any of this stuff, so I could be completely wrong about all of this. So here's the thing. A lady's dead, and she died having a baby. She didn't die because she was hit by lightning, or because her house burned down in the middle of the night. She's dead because of something that happened while she was having a baby."
"So?"
"So they're gonna have to blame someone. Look at all the reporters who started calling already."
Behind us, the phone rang again, and this time Tom didn't even look up. He just kept staring at the knees of his blue jeans, as yet another unfamiliar voice asked my mother to call him back when she returned. 15 years ago, I always expected I'd be arrested one day. I marched against the war. I called police officers pigs. I smoked more than my share of pot. But I guess I never got mad enough, or wild enough, or stoned enough to do something really crazy. Maybe I would have, if I hadn't been blessed with Connie. I knew plenty of girls then who would give a trooper the finger while holding their baby in their other arm. But that wasn't me. My baby was always too precious to me to screw around like that. I remember that Rand was picked up once and herded into a wagon. He was one of dozens and dozens of guys arrested in a Washington, D.C. protest. I think Rand only spent a night in the jail, and he was never charged with anything. And unlike me, he never had to wear handcuffs. Stephen said it was all a formality, but I don't think anyone who's ever had state troopers show up at her house and arrest her would call handcuffs a formality. "Now, I don't really think that's necessary, do you?" Stephen asked the two officers. "We don't have a choice, Stephen, you know that," the fellow with the mustache said. And so right there on my own front porch, they made me put out my arms so they could cuff me.
From the notebooks of Sybil Danforth, midwife. Stephen Hastings had not had many defendants in our cold, remote corner of the state. He usually worked in Burlington, where the sorts of crimes that might result in the need for a high-powered, by Vermont standards anyway, attorney, were most likely to occur. Stephen had defended the power company executive who was accused of drowning his wife in Lake Champlain, and the high school English teacher who was charged with having sex with 2 15-year-old girls from one of his classes. With Stephen's help, they were both found not guilty. While Stephen may have rarely wound up in the Orleans County Courthouse in Newport, he still knew the county state attorney fairly well. Vermont is a small state, and Stephen and Bill Tanner ran into each other at formal bar association functions in Montpelier. I didn't have a crush on Stephen Hastings, but it would have been understandable if I had. I imagine a lot of girls in my situation would have fallen madly in love with the fellow, given the fact that he was about as close as our family was going to get to having a white knight or cavalry officer ride into our lives and rescue us. Stephen was my father's age the summer and fall he defended my mother, and 2 years older than Sybil. The men around me that year were 36. The woman who was my world was 34. I didn't read newspapers much before my mother's name started to appear in them on a regular basis, so I never heard of Stephen before he entered our family's life. But I realized quickly that most adults around me had. His hair was just beginning to gray along his temples and across the pair of graceful boomerangs that served as eyebrows. It was more black than brown, and he kept it combed and trimmed with the discipline one might expect from an Air Force veteran. He was about my father's height, an inch or so short of 6 feet, and he was slightly heavier, but he'd never lost the muscles he'd found while training for Vietnam. He was recently divorced when he met my mother and father, but the marriage hadn't lasted very long,
or led to any children. Perhaps because I was a teen with a fairly predictable interest in clothing, I noticed that Stephen always seemed to be dressed slightly better than the men around him. If he was surrounded by attorneys in blazers and slacks at a Tuesday morning deposition, he would be wearing a suit. If the gentlemen around him at a Saturday night cocktail party were wearing khaki pants, his slacks would be gray. Even one Sunday at a picnic that summer, before which the adults must have decided en masse that they would all appear in blue jeans, he alone chose to wear chinos. Twilled, yes, but ironed and crisp and beige. "One click above," he explained that day to my father and me, rolling his eyes and laughing at himself, after my father had made some comment about his habit of always dressing a tad better than the world around him. "To win at what I do, and let's face it, charge what I charge, demands dressing exactly one click above everyone else. Not two clicks, because then I look like an idiot. One. One click makes me look pricey, and I hope, worth it."
"I hope so, too," my father agreed, the tone belying a tension otherwise veiled by his words.
Stephen never treated me like a child, which at that age meant a great deal to me. Twice he bought me punk albums from a record store in Burlington. He always seemed enormously interested in my father's work, and I think by the time the trial began he knew so much about home birth he could have delivered a breech in a bedroom by himself. I know that sometimes my father felt Stephen had become too much a part of our family's life, but that seemed to me a reasonable price to secure my mother's acquittal. Looking back, I think Stephen simply decided that, or as in actuality these things tend to work, discovered that he cared for my mother, and he wanted to be around us all as much as he could. His gifts, in my mind, were always genuine, his embraces avuncular and sincere. Barely 48 hours would slip by between the Saturday my parents met Stephen Hastings in Burlington and the Monday evening he appeared at our house in Reddington with a photographer and I was introduced to him. While we all held out hopes as the state conducted its investigation throughout March that Bill Tanner would decide not to prosecute, Stephen was adamant that my parents should prepare for the worst. A charge of involuntary manslaughter stemming from my mother's recklessness or extreme negligence. "Bill may even make some noise about it being intentional," Stephen had warned that Saturday afternoon.
"What does that mean?" my father had asked.
Stephen turned in his chair to address my mother directly. "If he suggests you acted intentionally, it means he believes he can win with a charge of voluntary manslaughter, not merely involuntary. Maybe even second-degree murder. Of course it won't come to that. I don't think Bill could find a precedent for such a thing on God's green earth. I'm just warning you, he might make noise to that effect early on." Stephen wanted to take steps right away to begin building a defense, just in case, and my parents agreed. He wanted photographs of the scrapes and bruises my mother had received on the ice that Friday morning in Lawson, and the sprained ankle upon which she was hobbling. He wanted to examine Charlotte Bedford's prenatal records with the physician, and he said he'd probably bring on board an investigator right away. And he gave my mother some advice. "Don't talk to anybody about this, not a soul. Don't tell anybody anything, and don't tell me everything. I'll ask you what I need to know as we move along. And try not to worry. I know you will, but you shouldn't. In my opinion, the state should damn well be giving you a medal for saving that baby's life, not threatening you like a gang of legal thugs." Of course, there were signals right away that should have told my parents that any hopes they had that the state would not press charges were unfounded, any optimism unwarranted. Throughout the Friday, Saturday, and Sunday that followed Charlotte's death, my mother kept expecting Ann Austin to call. My mother was genuinely concerned that her young apprentice had been so deeply scarred by what she had seen, she would give up her plans of becoming a midwife herself someday. Consequently, my mother phoned her on Saturday morning before she and my father went in search of attorneys, and again when they returned at the end of the day. She called Sunday morning, and again Sunday night. My mother left a message each time. When Anne failed to call back, my mother wondered aloud if Anne had gone to Massachusetts to visit her parents and put some literal distance between herself and the house where Charlotte Bedford had died. "And for all we know, she's tried reaching you a dozen times and got nothing but busy signals," my father added. The Sunday newspapers, too, should have been a pretty good indication that the state would prosecute. Saturday morning there had been merely a couple of 3 or 4 inch articles in the Burlington Free Press, and the Caledonian Record noting that Charlotte Fugit Bedford had died during a home birth, but there was no mention of Sybil Danforth. Sunday's stories, however, were very different. They were lengthy, more detailed, and grisly. They also lacked my mother's perspective on that long night in the Bedford's bedroom, because she had chosen not to return any of the phone calls from reporters that Saturday. And while Stephen explained to my parents that they should forward press inquiries to him, they didn't know that as they sat in his office the first time, and so there were no comments from Stephen Hastings in Sunday's stories either. Consequently, the articles that ran on Sunday were not only gory, they were one-sided and wrong. They were filled with quotes from doctors and midwives who hadn't been in the room with my mother, people who were willing to conjecture about what must have happened or what might have occurred. The OBGYN from North Country Hospital, who greeted Vale soon after he was born, was happy to talk both about what he knew, the boy was fine, and what he didn't, why the mother wasn't. "We've all been lulled into believing that birth is as safe as having a cavity filled or a broken arm set," Dr. André Dumond told reporters. "Obviously, as this incident proves, it's not. The list of things that can go wrong in a home birth is frightening and it is endless. That's why doctors prefer the technological and institutional support of a hospital." Even as a 13-year-old, I can recall thinking as I read this remark that I personally wouldn't have had my teeth filled at home or a broken arm set in my bedroom, but I still understood his point, and I knew other people would as well. "At this point, I have no idea whether the poor woman would have died in a hospital. I don't know all the details yet of what happened. Would she have had her stomach ripped open with a kitchen knife? Of course not. Would she have had to endure a cesarean section without anesthesia? Of course not." Of the half dozen doctors who could have met my mother and Vale when they arrived at North Country Hospital, Dumond was the worst choice from my family's perspective. My mother and Dumond knew each other, and they disliked each other. I have no doubt that Dumond was a fine obstetrician, but he was in his mid-50s then, and he was the sort of doctor midwives refer to euphemistically as interventionist. He believed that birth was a dangerous business, and it demanded constant monitoring and lots of drugs. In some articles, an anonymous official in the state's attorney's office, in all likelihood Bill Tanner himself, explained that Vermont was investigating the death. "We won't know for a while whether there's a basis for criminal charges or whether it's merely a civil matter," the source said, suggesting that even if the state didn't press charges, my mother could expect to be sued for every penny she had. Only the reporter from the Little Newport Chronicle tracked down Asa Bedford for a short statement. "I'm very, very grateful that I have been blessed with another child, but I don't even know how to begin to convey my grief over Charlotte's death. I just don't have those words. I'm sorry. I shouldn't say anything more." He didn't preach on Sunday morning. By early May, he had left Vermont and returned to Alabama, where he had family. Some weeks later, his expression, "I shouldn't say anything more," would take on a life of its own for my father. For a time, he became convinced that either Bill Tanner or some ambulance-chasing attorney had told Asa to say that, to make sure the Reverend didn't say anything that would come back to haunt the Bedfords when they took the Danforths to court. And even if the words hadn't been suggested to Asa by a lawyer, the Sunday morning we saw them, we should have realized they, along with the observations of Dr. Dumond and the source in the state's attorney's office, meant that my mother was going to trial. For almost 30 minutes, Mark Truchon photographed my mother in the living room, snapping pictures of parts of her body against a small white backdrop. In addition to her sprained ankle, she had bruises dotting both of her legs, including what I understand was a strawberry on her thigh, so painful she was unable to wear jeans. Quickly, I followed Stephen Hastings into the kitchen to give my mother and the photographer their privacy. "Where do you keep glasses, Connie? I really would love a drink of water," Stephen said, wiping his eyeglasses with a white handkerchief. I opened the cabinet door and reached for 2 glasses. Then, remembering how my mother was always offering people coffee and herbal tea, I pulled down the metal container in which my mother kept tea bags. "Would you like coffee instead, or herbal tea? Does your family own stock in some coffee or tea company?" "I don't know," I answered, not realizing until after I'd opened my mouth that this was a joke. "No," he went on, "water would be perfect right now." I filled each glass from the kitchen sink. "What are you doing next?" He removed a tape recorder from one of his blazer's front pockets. I'm just going to ask her a few questions. Nothing too tough tonight.
You're not going to take notes?
Oh, good Lord, no.
That's what the police did.
Well, the police have their methods and I have mine. And you know what?
What?
Mine are a whole lot better.
It may have been the confident way that he spoke, and it may have been the ramrod way that he stood. It may have been the way he was dressed, that one click above blazer. It may have been all of those things combined. But I went to sleep that night absolutely convinced that if my mother indeed needed a lawyer, and in all of our minds that still wasn't a sure thing, she had the best one in Vermont.
Connie had a cup of coffee with breakfast yesterday. First time, but I think it's going to become a regular thing. She just shuffled into the kitchen and started pouring herself a cup. I think I must have been staring by the way she stopped mid-pour and then looked over at me. Okay if I have a cup? And that's when this really weird sentence formed in my head, the sort of sentence I can hear my own mother saying to me. Don't you think you're a little young? So I just nodded like, you know, no big deal. And while on the one hand it isn't, it's coffee and she sees her dad and mom practically mainlining the stuff, on the other hand, it is. It's one more step for our girl. I want to write little girl, but she hasn't been a little girl in years. She's always been very mature for her age, but she has some moments these days when she seems totally grown up to me. When she met Stephen, she was this little diplomat, making sure he had whatever he needed, asking him these really good questions and telling him these really funny stories. She even asked him if he could stay for dinner, just like a little diplomat, just like a young diplomat. Not little, young. And while he couldn't stay for dinner last night, I have a feeling he will be having dinner with us other nights this spring. Connie will have to see a lot of him, which is only unfortunate because of what he does, not because of who he is. I know Connie's scared. I know I'm scared. I don't know what to do about that in either of our cases. Here's what I think I'll do about the coffee. She can have coffee in the morning before school, but not after dinner, because she is still growing and she does need her sleep. That's how we'll handle this coffee thing. From the Notebooks of Sybil Danforth, Midwife. When Charlotte Fugit Bedford died, the midwives were scared. The lay midwives, that is, the ones without any medical training, the ones who did the home births, not the nurse midwives. They worked with doctors and delivered babies in hospitals and had no reason to be frightened. But the lay midwives feared, rightly it would prove, that the medical community would try and use the woman's death as an indictment of home birth in general. As winter slowly gave way to spring, however, and my mother was charged with a crime and treated like a criminal, when the midwives learned the conditions of my mother's bail, their fear quickly grew into anger. Fury, to be precise. Moreover, if, as Tom Quartz had put it, doctors are predatory pack animals like wolves, then midwives are herd animals like elephants. Attack one, and the others will rush to the wounded animal and do all that they can to defend it. In the months after Charlotte Fugit Bedford died, our house was filled with midwives. Sometimes they came with food as if someone in our family had died. Sometimes they came with flowers. Occasionally, they brought with them the names of other midwives around the country who had also experienced a, to use the midwife's euphemism for virtually any fatality, bad outcome. Sometimes they appeared with the names of those women's lawyers, a gesture which initially I assumed Stephen Hastings would find threatening. I was wrong. He was thrilled. Early on, he asked my mother to share with him the names of these midwives and their attorneys so he could discuss with them their trials and their defense strategies. The midwives who visited us came from all over New England and upstate New York, and a few traveled distances that absolutely astonished me. These women, regardless of whether they were from a rural corner of northern New Hampshire or an urban neighborhood in Boston, regardless of how well they knew my mother, were huggers. They never shook her hand when they met her. They always embraced her. This went for my father, too, if he happened to be home, and for Stephen Hastings, if he happened to be visiting. These were not the sort of mannered little squeezes society matrons or youthful debutantes might share. These were emphatic bear hugs of impressively long duration. The Vermont midwives, all of whom knew my mother, rallied around her like Secret Service agents around a president who's been shot. Cheryl Visco and Donnell Foligno organized a quilt sale to raise money for my mother's legal defense fund, while Molly Thompson and Megan Blubow wrote hundreds of fundraising letters on her behalf. I know of at least three young women living in Vermont today who are named Sybil, each of whom was a baby born at home in the summer or fall of 1981. Their names are not insignificant homage to my mother. And of course, the midwives helped out my mother by accepting her pregnant clients as patients once the state insisted she stop practicing, at least temporarily, as a condition for bail. Most of the time, I think, my father was glad to see my mother receiving all of the support from the midwives. It took some of the pressure off him. Sometimes it boosted his spirits, too. And as a family, we really did eat very well that spring and summer. But there were other times when my father grew irritated, tired of the way his home had become a coffee house for a new age world of women in sandals, for tireless earth mothers in wraparound paisley skirts. I think he found Cheryl Visco especially annoying. Cheryl would drop by almost every other day for no other reason than to offer moral support. Sometimes she'd appear with one flower, sometimes with a note card she thought was funny. When she arrived late on a weekday afternoon, she would stay for dinner. When she arrived on a weekend morning, she would stay for lunch. The days were indeed growing longer as March became April, but, as my father said, when Cheryl was there, they seemed to last forever. Cheryl was probably in her early 50s then, but she was still a beautiful woman. Her hair was gray, and unlike most gray hair, it still looked magnificent long. It fell like curtains down her back, usually draping a tight black sweater or the top of a long-sleeved but close-fitting black dress. Cheryl was close to 6 feet tall, more slender than most women half her age, and the subject of all sorts of rumor and gossip. She had three children from three different fathers, only one of whom she had actually bothered to marry. What I believe did her relationships in was her truly astonishing ability to speak for hours at a time without stopping to breathe. Some nights when I would go upstairs to do my homework around 8:30, I would leave her lecturing my parents. I'd hear my father escaping soon after, trudging upstairs with the excuse that he was tired. Later, when Cheryl had finally gone home and my mother had struggled upstairs herself, I'd hear my father comment angrily on Cheryl's uncanny ability to outstay her welcome. Some nights his tone was more caustic than others. Some nights his voice was louder. On the quieter nights, he might simply remark, "She can't keep a husband because she can't shut up." But when he was particularly disgusted, or he'd had an extra scotch during dinner, I might hear him raise his voice as he said, "We have enough stress in our lives without her. The next time she shows up and won't leave, call me. Call me and I'll sleep at the damn office." My mother would then shut their bedroom door, and I would wait silently at my desk, listening, wondering if tonight the fight would blow up or blow over. We learned on Monday night what had happened to Anne Austin, my mother's apprentice. We learned because B.P. Hewitt, Dr. Brian Hewitt, called from the hospital during dinner and said he wanted to drop by when he finished his rounds. Dr. Hewitt was more than a decade older than my parents, and his hair, vaguely camel-colored, was always flying around his forehead and flopping over the tops of his ears. B.P. delivered his patients' babies in hospitals, of course, and he would testify that he believed hospitals were the safest place for newborns to arrive. But he also said he understood that some women were going to have their babies at home regardless of what he believed, and he was happy to back up the right sort of midwife. My mother, apparently, was the right sort of midwife. As her backup physician, he agreed to be on call to go to the hospital when my mother transferred one of her own patients there. Since my mother took women to the hospital only when she feared a complication, the majority of the time he was anticipating a cesarean section. In the 9 years that BP had backed up my mother, the records would show that 28 times she had transferred a patient to the hospital. All but once, the baby had been fine. Once, the baby was stillborn, born dead. Never did a mother die. And on that occasion when the baby was born dead, BP and the medical examiner were quite sure that the baby would have been born dead even if his mother had endured her labor in a hospital. And no one, as far as I know, ever hinted that my mother might have been somehow to blame. When BP arrived at our house that Monday night, he looked tired and preoccupied. While he told my parents why he had stopped by, I cleaned up the kitchen. I was careful to make just enough noise that my parents would assume I was focused upon the dishes, but not so much that I couldn't hear most of what the adults were saying. "She called about an hour after you did, Sybil, maybe 45 minutes," BP told them. "Friday morning?" my mother asked. "Yeah."
She was that concerned?
Evidently.
Why didn't she just call me?
Didn't she?
No.
You two haven't spoken to each other since...
since the birth?
Sybil's been trying to reach her for 3 days, my father said.
I slowed the water pouring from the tap to a trickle. I began to feel dizzy. They were talking about Anne, I realized, my mother's new apprentice.
You two haven't spoken, you two haven't seen each other, the doctor's voice again.
And it was something like surprise, something like concern, concern for my mother.
I asked her to call you, talk to you.
She didn't.
She's still in Vermont? My father asked. I believe so.
Then I'll see her tomorrow, my mother told BP.